out. And that was 7 o'clock. Keep it right here for Your Legal Rights with Jeff Hayden.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. The end of the year rapidly approaching, we present the legal landscape and how things may be changing in just a couple of weeks. This is especially interesting this year in that new legislation is the potential to classify many or most independent contractors as employees beginning the first of the year. Or does it? In conjunction with the Labor and Employment Law section of the California Lawyers Association, we're talking about new laws for 2020. My guests will be labor and employment attorneys, Thomas Lenz, a partner in Atkinson, Andelson, Loya, Rood, and Romo in Pasadena, and Scott Stillman from McGuinn, Hillsman, Pilevsky in San Francisco. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number to us right here in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local dialing area, that's outside of San Francisco, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Occasionally, I neglect to mention that while we're happy to answer all of your questions, we stop short of giving precise legal advice, as we don't have all of the facts relating to a given case, but we're more than happy to pass along the legal principles that help guide your decision-making. And as always, you can call regarding any question. Tonight, we're talking about labor and employment law. You can call about any questions in the area, particularly as it relates to new laws for 2020. You're not limited to where we may be in our conversation. And again, our toll-free number is 866-798-8255. But before we begin, I'm pleased to announce the return for the last time in 2019 of Call a Lawyer Night. Available for your queries, we have Frank Adam of Pacifica to handle your questions on tax law, real estate law, Nate Bigger of San Francisco to answer your calls with family law, collection defense, landlord-tenant law. Janet Frankel is here to talk family law, a certified specialist. Janet has offices in San Francisco, as does Robert Wyman. Rob is a workers' compensation certified specialist, also out of San Francisco. Also, to answer your queries, we have Janet Brewer, a certified specialist in estate planning. Janet Brewer has offices in Palo Alto. For landlord-tenant law, Jessica Chalik of San Francisco. You have questions about employment, wage and hour, personal injury claims, probate, Bruce Bernstein of San Francisco. For your bankruptcy law questions, Leon Bayer of Los Angeles, a certified specialist. And again, if you have questions for our lawyers, for Call a Lawyer, that you don't want to talk on the air, you have those questions, call 800-525-9917. That's 800-KALW-917. But for tonight, on the air, we're talking about new employment laws for 2020. And with that, Scott, Tom, let me welcome you both to Your Legal Rights.
Thanks for having us, Jeff.
Tom, are you patched in?
I am. Can you hear me?
We can now. And welcome.
Excellent.
To Call a Lawyer. Welcome to Your Legal Rights. Before we go further, I'd like to start with this. You know, we talked a little bit on a show a few weeks back when we were talking about the gig economy, but it seems to me the single biggest story this year is AB 5 and how many contractors are now going to be considered employees. Tell us a little bit of the landscape there.
Yeah, I mean, this is Scott. I think, you know, AB bill, and I think once again it really shows that California is a leader in protecting workers. It's going to give millions of Californians job benefits and protections that they previously didn't have. And it addresses this real trend that's been happening over the past number of decades around misclassifying workers as independent contractors. The legislature said when passing this bill that misclassification has been a significant factor in the erosion of the middle class and the rise in income equality. And, you know, why is that? Well, unlike contractors, employees receive broad protections and benefits under California law, including minimum wage, overtime, meal and rest breaks, sick pay, unemployment and disability insurance. You get protections under the anti-discrimination laws. You have leave law rights. I mean, the list is long and robust. And a few other points about misclassification before we get into the actual meat of AB 5. Misclassification also results in businesses trying to compete with other businesses who may be breaking the law. And so it's tough for a business, you know, trying to follow and do the right thing to compete in that landscape. Additionally, there's a big loss in state revenue that comes from misclassification of workers. So that means that the state is not getting payroll taxes, and the Division of Labor Standards and Enforcement estimated that an annual loss of $7 billion with a B per year in payroll tax revenue that's lost. So it's a big deal when we get to, you know, how to address this. And AB 5 basically codifies a Supreme Court of California case called Dynamex, which held that California workers performing services are presumptively assumed to be employees. And it's going to be the employer's burden under this new ABC test to prove that the worker is, in fact, an independent contractor. Tom, I don't know if you want to walk us through the ABC test.
Sure. Glad to, Scott. The ABC test is a big change from the tests that have historically controlled whether someone is an employee or an independent contractor. And it boils down to three factors. The three factors, A, is whether a person is free from the control and direction of the hiring entity in connection with the performance of the work, both under the contract for the performance of the work and in fact. So are you really doing this on your own, in your own way, or is somebody telling you how to do it? B, which is the biggest hurdle, it seems, in this analysis, the person performs work that is outside the usual course of the hiring entity's business. And on that point, if you're a trucking company and you hire truck drivers as independent contractors, that's a problem. But if you are a trucking company and your sink is clogged and you call a plumber who comes and fixes the sink, that's more like an independent contractor. Because it's a different type of business.
So, Tom, from my own perspective, I'm an attorney. I'm a criminal defense attorney. And I'll tell you for reasons in a moment why I find AB 5 is not, from my perspective, as easy to follow as it might be at first blush. But from what, if I understand you correctly, if I have somebody in my office contributing to my legal work product, they may not have to be an attorney. But if they're doing research for me or something, they may be employees. But if I've got them painting the office or cleaning up afterwards or maybe wiring up the place so that my internet works better, they may be contractors under that test.
Correct.
And I didn't mean to jump right in and stop you. I just wanted to put in a parenthetical note because I'm beginning to understand some of this stuff.
Excellent. And we've got one more factor. That is factor C. That the person is customarily engaged in the independently established trade, occupation, or business of the same nature as that involved in the work performed. So, really, is the person at issue an independent operating business that doesn't just serve you, but they serve other customers? If you restrict them, or if they are dependent on solely your business, then I think that's going to be a factor in favor of employee status rather than independent contractor status.
So if I have a solo practice in criminal law, yes, I do, and I have a bookkeeper that does my books now and again, along with 30 other people that she works for, she's probably more likely to get over that hurdle and be an independent contractor than if I have a large firm with lots and lots of employees and we're doing our own payroll and perhaps accounting for client funds and the like, and I have a bookkeeper on staff.
I think so. And the details matter, and the burden is going to be on that hiring entity, or in this case you, to show that this is truly something that satisfies all three of those ABC factors.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as you can imagine, with this law being as big a deal as it is, there was a lot of lobbying that went on to try to carve out certain exemptions. And so the law actually does have tons of exemptions where different industries sort of lobbied to say, well, we shouldn't have to follow the ABC test. And if you don't follow, if you are one of these industries that are exempt, for instance, you know, commercial fishermen working on American vessels are exempt until December 31, 2022, just to pick a random example, you are still need to follow what they call the Barillo test, which is basically has a multi-factor test with a bunch of different questions, but it really comes down to kind of, is somebody controlling your work and directing you to do that job, or are you able to operate more independently?
The exemptions are really, I think, the part that confuses me. You can understand how those came into being. Some of them started out with policy, and then it grew as more and more industries might have fought the legislation, and suddenly to come into the fold for various reasons they were able to lobby or get themselves exempt. But you look at things, and the way that I read this now, it looks like someone like a hairstylist is exempt.
Right.
But you look at a session musician who might be helping a budding artist lay down tracks to get their first album, and suddenly they're going to come back and say they were an employee. And it seems to be almost random.
It does seem that
there is a certain randomness, and I think often in the case of, you know, lobbying and seeking things in terms of legislative reform, some people are aware and active and other folks aren't, and this is a case of the people who were out there talking about it perhaps getting a bit of change. And even if you're not subject to the ABC test, you may still be an independent contractor under the Barillo test. So you're not entirely out of the woods, even if you got one of these exemptions.
So the first thing I walked away with when I read it all and saw the various list of exemptions, and some have time limits on them, and the exemption will go away, and some of them don't, and it seems that they're kind of a random hit. It seems to me that for most folks, the right thing to do is to consult with somebody, because you're not necessarily going to figure it all out yourself.
That's very true. In fact, I represent employers, and I'm spending a lot of time talking to employers about whether their individual workforce, you know, be it people they consider employees or people they consider independent contractors, satisfy the ABC test or an exemption to perhaps have the Barillo test apply. And it really is detail-oriented in particular to each person, as well as the nature of the work. And then some of these exemptions, such as business-to-business or referral agencies, are frankly issues that are, I think, going to be litigated or require further clarification through legislative or regulatory reform to really provide people clarity in how to follow this law.
Yeah, I think if we fast forward to this time next year at the same show, we're going to be talking about all the different other exemptions that the legislature probably passed, and also clarifications, like Tom mentioned, that went into effect, because there's still a lot to be figured out in how this is going to play itself out. You still have, you know, the gig economy is particularly impacted by this, and, you know, to see what Uber and Lyft are going to do, for instance, they're already working on trying to create a ballot initiative and put this to the voters. Additionally, one aspect of this AB5 that we haven't talked about is it actually gives the attorney general and certain city attorneys power to seek injunctive relief of these continued misclassification of employees. And I think you're probably going to see Uber, for instance, is taking the position that they are properly labeling their employee or their people who are driving for them as independent contractors. That I think that's still going to be their position in 2020. And so I would hope to see city attorney offices and attorney general's offices filing for injunctive relief. That's going to be probably another way that, that AB 5 might be put to the test.
And I think an interesting thing in the governor's signing message on AB 5 was, as Scott mentioned earlier, if you are an independent contractor as opposed to an employee, you miss out on certain things that the law provides for employees. One of those is labor organizing rights, and the signing message from the governor indicates that California intends to do more legislatively to expand the rights of individuals to organize and be represented collectively through a labor union. That's typically regulated by federal law, but if the state feels federal law is lacking on that, yeah, this is something where we may see further developments.
So it sounds like this may be a shot in the arm in some ways for labor in California, at least, and maybe to make somewhat of a rebound.
That's true, and labor has been pushing for reform like this.
It's a fascinating topic, and nobody really knows where it's going, except I would predict that before next year is out, we'll see it coming on a future ballot soon to come, and I think it's going to be in the courtroom very quickly, maybe within the first month of the year.
Yeah, I think
there's a lot of folks that aren't going to like it.
Yeah, no,
absolutely,
it's going to get a lot of attention.
Either because they're fighting the idea, or because they feel they've been left behind and want to come to the party. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. In conjunction with the Labor and Employment Law section of the California Lawyers Association, we're talking about new employment laws for 2020. My guests tonight are labor and employment attorneys Thomas Lenz from Pasadena, California, and Scott Stillman from right here in San Francisco. If you have questions from our guests, our phone number to ask in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the dialing area, call us toll-free, 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. So we've been talking a bit about AB 5, and so far we've talked about the codification of dynamics. So what if I am in an industry that was written out, or perhaps my particular job within an industry is written out? Am I out of luck?
I don't think you are, because I guess it depends on what perspective you're asking the question from, because I think if you are potentially an independent contractor in some area that wasn't excluded, like Tom mentioned, there's going to be you're either going to be an independent contractor or an employee. So that question is still needs to be resolved, regardless of if it's under the ABC test or the Borrello test. If you're just the industry itself who is looking to get the exemption because you think maybe the Borrello test shouldn't apply to you, then I think you'll probably see some lobbying efforts to get an exemption passed.
Tell us a little bit about the Borrello test. And I don't expect any of our listeners to necessarily remember it by name, but how do they know if maybe there's a second chance for them to come in as an employee when perhaps their employer thought they were independent contractors?
The Borrello test is going to be a more multi-factored test, which is traditionally how the law has looked at the distinction between employees and independent contractors, and it relies heavily on what is known as the right of control. And if a hiring entity has control over things like scheduling and the manner in which work is performed, and there is a reporting expectation, I think those are the sorts of things that will be relied upon to say, this is not just somebody coming in, doing a project, and leaving. This is the more details you have along those lines, the more it's going to look like employment.
Let me turn it to Mary in San Francisco. You're on Your Legal Rights. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm curious. I work as a dance teaching artist throughout the Bay Area. And so when I teach at dance studios, I get paid a percentage of the number of people who come to my class. So I'm wondering, how does going from being an independent contractor to an employee change my wages? Can I still get paid based on volume of attendance?
Well, if you were an employee, you would certainly be entitled to and must be paid at least a minimum wage. And then after that, it would be up to your company and you to have a negotiation as to what your hourly rate should be and what that amount would come to, and whether or not you guys tie that to what has traditionally been the average of the percentage of people who show up for your classes. You know, maybe that's the way that it's done, but I think it certainly the way in which you are paid would be changing as an employee, going from an independent contractor to an employee.
So I could theoretically go to a fixed rate rather than a flexible range?
Yeah, theoretically, I think you could.
Okay.
And if Mary became an employee as opposed to an independent contractor, would she be eligible for a lot of other rights that perhaps a contractor wouldn't have?
Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, number one, you all of a sudden fall under the protections of the California Labor Code, which independent contractors don't fall under. You are entitled to make sure that your workplace has workers' compensation. If, for instance, if you did get injured on the job, you would be able to collect workers' comp as you recuperate, whereas right now that wouldn't be the case. If you get sick, for instance, and aren't able to show up for one of your classes, and you're in San Francisco, you would be getting you can get a certain amount of paid sick leave. So there are a ton of advantages and benefits and protections that come from being an employee.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mary, thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights. I have a close friend who's similarly situated to Mary in a related but different industry. I'm wondering a couple things. Obviously, the person for whom he works might think that if him and people like him are employees rather than contractors, the cost of doing business has certainly gone up, and they may not want to stay in business. Is this something that people can contract around?
Tom, do you want to field that one?
You know, I think that it is something that should be discussed with the hiring entity. I mean, I think more often than not, it's going to be an employee relationship. But are you really holding yourself out as a distinct business? I think it's hard to answer that more specifically without further details on what's going on.
So it goes back to my original thought, which is there are times where the application of this is going to be a little hard for lay people to figure. And for somebody like Mary or someone like him, it would probably be advisable to at least talk to somebody at the front end, talk to someone that could give them specific advice to their situation.
I think that's true, and I think it's also important to know that people performing work will be presumed to be employees. It's a high bar to prove, to show that someone is not an employee.
So is there anything else you wanted to add, either of you, to our discussions of AB5?
Not right now.
Yeah, no, I would be happy to move on to AB 51.
And AB 51 is, for people that aren't familiar with it, we're talking about restrictions on labor code rights and the like, fair employment and housing rights. Tell us a little bit about what AB 51 does.
Yeah, I think AB 51 really deals with the issue of forced arbitration. And it's been a years-long effort to try to protect workers from being forced to sign arbitration agreements. And, you know, maybe before I get into the details of the bill, just some quick background on what arbitration is. It's kind of a supposed to be a private justice system that takes place outside of the court system. I think in reality, it's really been a cancer on our justice system. And I'm hoping that AB 51 can start to be somewhat of a remedy for that cancer, in part because arbitration, it's sold as this sort of separate but equal justice system, but I think in many ways it's the exact opposite. And, you know, I represent employees, so I see all the time that an employee will come to me with an issue at their workplace, and I have to say, you know, well, did you sign an arbitration agreement? And the first thing they do most of the time is say, I have no idea what that is. I don't know. And I say, well, let me see your offer letter. You know, and sure enough, buried on page 10 in small fine print, it talks about, oh, yeah, you agree to bring all of your cases into arbitration if you ever have any dispute with the company. And you're waiving your right to a jury trial. I mean, one of the most fundamental things that we have in the, you know, the justice system is the right to the jury trial, and you're waiving that without most of the time even knowing it.
Part of the as a defense attorney, I'm particularly sensitive to the idea of a right to a jury. We use the expression "a jury of your peers," but as a practical matter, we're talking about a fair cross section of the community. And my big concerns when I look at arbitration is very much as when I'm looking at an administrative remedy. Instead of going to court, I have to go to an administrative body. And one side of the case is typically an employer or a government entity that goes back to the same person, the same arbitrator, over and over and over. And I'm the guy they're seeing this time, this day. And it really creates an imbalance of power. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco, where I'm pleased to announce the return of Call a Lawyer Night, available for your queries. Frank Adams there to answer your questions of tax law or real estate law. Nate Bigger for family law, collection defense, landlord-tenant law. Janet Frankel, a certified specialist, there to talk to you about family law. Rob Wyman, a certified specialist, available for workers' compensation law. Janet Brewer, also a certified specialist for estate planning. Jessica Chalik, landlord-tenant law. Bruce Bernstein, wage and hour employment claims, personal injury claims, probate law. And for bankruptcy, Leon Baer, a certified specialist of Los Angeles. If you have questions for Call a Lawyer that you do not want to discuss on the air, the number is 800-525-9917. That's 800-KALW-917. But for tonight, we're talking about new laws for 2020. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KLW is provided by the Bar's Association of San Francisco. And if you happen to live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar's Association Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet an attorney experienced in the area in law related to your situation. You can always call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
But tonight, we're here, we're talking on the radio about new laws, new employment laws for 2020. With me in the studio, employment and labor attorneys Tom Lenz of Pasadena and Scott Stillman of San Francisco. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number to us in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, call us toll-free at 866-798-7266. 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And let me turn it to Rachel in Berkeley. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, thank you for taking the call. I was wondering, if I hire a neighbor on a, you know, occasional basis to run errands or to help out in the garden, at what stage does it become an employer relationship? And we have a teenage son who takes out our trash on a regular basis. Like, where are the different degrees of when someone becomes is considered an employee?
This is Tom, and I'll start off by saying that people who work for other people are presumed to be employees. So, if you hire someone to do such things for you, they will be presumed to be an employee. If a dispute arises, an issue over pay or something, then, and if you contend that they are an independent contractor, the burden would be on you to show, subject to the applicable test, the applicable factors like we've been talking about, that they are in fact an independent contractor rather than an employee as presumed.
And this is Scott.
I think it's a good question. I think that one of the tests under the ABC test is sort of, is this person performing work outside the hiring entity's, you know, usual business? And so I think in the case of if it's just your household and you're hiring somebody to take out the trash, you know, the question is, well, I mean, is that, are you really a business? Is that what your core business is, you're just running the household? So I'm not sure necessarily that this would be something that would make you an employer. I mean, it does go back to, I agree with Tom's presumption, but I think, as you can tell by even just having this conversation, it starts to get into a very detailed case-by-case analysis.
Yeah, that's for sure. And, you know, we've seen cases over the years with domestic assistants and, you know, people who work in the household environment, and those are often employment situations. And, we've seen issues arise in the media where someone has maybe not paid taxes, not provided a W-2, things along those lines. So I think it's the sort of situation that may well fly under the radar, but technically I would look to that presumption.
Yeah, and there's also certain monetary requirements that somebody must be paid until before, you know, you have to start to issue somebody like a W-2 and things like that. So that would be another area where you could look into that.
True.
Oh, okay.
You know, one thing you can do, and what I found in this area is it's new, it's actually coming up pretty quickly. For a lay perspective, or even for me as a lawyer, and I'm not an employment attorney, I think it's maybe one of those areas that if you're really not sure where you're going to come on which side of the line, it might be something that's worth a very small investment to talk to a lawyer at the lawyer referral service, get a sense of it from someone who practices employment law that can look at your situation in a little more detail than we can tonight. I would recommend that you consider the Alameda County Bar Association. Since you're calling from Berkeley, they're at 510-302-2222. And they can assist you. All the local bars have low-cost lawyer referrals, and if there was ever a time to tap into it, this is one.
That's great. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us on Your Legal Rights. So, AB 51.
Yeah, so I think I covered a little bit about arbitration and what it is, and basically what AB 51 does, it doesn't really explicitly mention or selectively call out arbitration contracts, but it does kind of give the employee the option to not enter into a contract that has an arbitration agreement to begin with. And the way it does that is by, it says that prohibits employers from conditioning employment or any employment-related benefit on the applicant or employee waiving rights under the Fair Employment and Housing Act and the California Labor Code, including one of those rights, and this is kind of where it gets to the arbitration, including the right to proceed in civil court. And so it also prohibits employers from retaliating against an applicant or employee for refusing to waive employment-related rights, such as going to court, and it deems violations of AB 51 an unfair employment practice under the Fair Employment and Housing Act, or referred to as FEHA.
So I'm a job applicant. They've offered me a position. I say great. I accept the terms. They give me the paperwork, and I line out all references to waiving these protections. And they can't say we thought better of hiring you there.
Yeah, I mean, that under this new law, that would be retaliation for, you know, you deciding that, no, I don't want to waive my right to go into court and proceed with a case under the FEHA or California Labor Code.
Yeah, this has been an area where in the past an employer would say, hey, look, yeah, this is a condition of employment, and by going to work for us, even if you don't sign off, you are implicitly accepting those terms. And I think now employers have to look at this with greater caution, and they have to reevaluate the sorts of terms they're putting forth before new employees. And, you know, employers went on, a major effort to create and impose arbitration agreements on their workplaces in the last few years based upon court decisions that have come out. And I think employers are going to have to retool their forms and consult competent counsel so that they address these issues in the right way. I think employers are going to be, they're going to have to be mindful of the voluntariness that will have to underlie any sort of mandatory arbitration on these issues. I mean, specifically as to you know, matters involving the Fair Employment and Housing Act and you know, issues involving discrimination in the workplace, and as well as the California Labor Code.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights, and I'm pleased to announce once again the return of Call a Lawyer Night, available for your queries. Frank Adam to answer your tax law, real estate law questions. Nate Bigger of San Francisco for family law, collection defense, landlord-tenant law. Janet Frankel is a certified specialist in family law. Rob Wyman, a certified specialist in workers' compensation law. Janet Brewer, a certified specialist in estate planning, trust, and probate law. Jessica Chalik of San Francisco to answer your landlord-tenant questions. Bruce Bernstein will deal with your wage and hour claims, personal injury claims, probate. And Leon Bayer of Los Angeles, a certified specialist in bankruptcy law. If you have questions for Call a Lawyer, the number that will not place you on the air is 800-525-9917. That's 800-KALW-917. And again, we're here tonight talking about new employment laws for 2020. That's basically 3 weeks away. Let me turn it to Krista in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. As a union member, I wanted to know how AB 51 would affect us, seeing how we already have to go through some sort of arbitration. How does this change anything for union members? Does it change anything?
I'm not sure
how that would work for us.
I don't believe that AB 51 changes the arbitration system for union members covered by a collective bargaining agreement with a grievance arbitration procedure. Typically, employees have voluntarily chosen a labor union to represent them, and the labor union has negotiated on behalf of employees to set the grievance and arbitration terms that will apply to resolving a dispute that presumably is grieved. And you know, sometimes those grievance procedures will cover issues involving the sorts of labor code sorts of issues or discrimination types of issues in a FEHA claim. But I think by and large, the unions are not going to have to deal with this. Union members are not going to be dealing with AB 51. It's going to be more a issue for the non-union workplace.
Okay, good to hear.
Tom Scott, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the analysis for employees versus employment law for labor law is somewhat different, because when you're dealing with collective bargaining, people are reading line by line all these contracts or negotiating everything pretty much across the board, whereas with an individual employee, it's no different than when you rent a car. You've got very, very long forms. Nobody reads through all of you. You have no idea what you've signed except where they point. And I can see where the law would treat them differently. Is that really what's going on here?
I think there is a difference in bargaining power and a difference in leverage that is inherent in that difference between employment arbitration and labor arbitration. In the labor arbitration class I teach at USC Law School, one of the things we talk about is arbitration and the grievance process leading up to it. It's all part of a mechanism designed to keep peace in the workplace. Typically, arbitration is, and I hate to use the expression, a quid pro quo for a no-strike clause. You don't have strikes or lockouts. You resolve things voluntarily through arbitration. On the other hand, with employment arbitration, it's often the employee faces whatever it is the employer presents them. And the California courts, the federal courts have provided certain limits over the years on what employers are allowed to do or require of employees, but you don't have that sort of collective representation or group dynamic to impact that bargaining. So employees have, I represent employers, and I'm going to say here, employees have often been at the mercy of what employers have presented to them. Provided that employers get good counsel, it may well be enforceable.
And as it relates to arbitration, I see a big difference between the two in the sense that when I'm dealing with an arbitrator who goes to the same employer over and over and over and knows them, and I'm coming in from outside, there's a very strong imbalance of power between the two of us, because they're connecting on a one-to-one, and if this arbitrator rules in a certain way too often, that employer may not come back. Whereas with a single employee, they don't have that kind of clout, and that may not be true with the union.
Yeah, I think that's totally right. I mean, there has been research into this area, and the repeat player effect is a very much a real thing in the non-unionized employee private arbitration justice system, because you are seeing the company puts into their arbitration agreement who the arbitration provider service is going to be, and so they're constantly going back and bringing business to those arbitrators versus I'm representing the employee. That employee is just going to have one case ever that goes in front of that arbitrator. And so, trust me, like word definitely gets around about arbitrators and their decisions. So I definitely can see, and whether or not, some of it is just unconscious too. It skews, how decisions are made, and the numbers back that up.
It would make sense if I know the same person that's coming back a lot. I may take what they say with a little more. I may pay them a little more deference in what they're saying, even if it sounds a little off. I may say, well, that person knows what they're talking about, and here you bring a stranger in front of me, someone I don't deal with every week. Well, we've spent a lot of time talking about arbitration. How does SB 707 change that, if at all?
Yeah, well, SB 707 is another bill that is aimed at the issue of arbitration because it is such a big deal in the workplace these days. And as if forced arbitration wasn't bad enough, here's what has been happening recently is there's been this emerging trend where employers are simply refusing to pay either the initial arbitration fee, which prevents the process from really ever getting off the ground, or employers are strategically withholding payments at the end of an arbitration in order to prevent the release of a favorable judgment to employees. Because in California, one of the inroads that has been made in the arbitration world is that because it is such an expensive system, unlike court, where an employee could go into court and pay a very small nominal filing fee, in arbitration, just to get things going, you're looking at paying the arbitrating company thousands of dollars. And so the courts have said that the company, for the most part, bears the brunt of paying the arbitration costs. And so what the employers and companies are doing is they're just not paying they're saying you have to go to arbitration, but then they're not actually paying the arbitrating service provider the fees to actually proceed with the arbitration. And these aren't just, you know, small companies that aren't paying. I'm talking about Uber, Lyft, Chipotle. These are all companies who have failed to pay the initial filing fee. So, for instance, with Uber, there was 12,500 arbitration demands that were filed against them, and they only paid an initial filing fee for just 296 of those cases, meaning, you know, the arbitration service provider, they're saying, well, we're not going to go forward if we're not getting paid. It's just like if taxpayers all of a sudden stop paying their taxes, the court system wouldn't have any money to pay judges and court reporters and things like that. So SB 707 basically aims at addressing this problem and says that if the employer fails to provide the required fees to initiate the arbitration within 30 days of its due date, the employer will be deemed to have materially breached the arbitration agreement, and the employee can either withdraw from the arbitration and file in court or go to court to try to compel arbitration under the contract. And similarly, if you're going along and the arbitration process has started, but all of a sudden they stop paying the bill, you sort of have similar remedies to withdraw the claim from arbitration and go to court, or try to compel the case to continue from there.
From my perspective so far, it seems that in an effort to try to level the playing field, it seems that most of these bills have been pretty much on the employee's side as opposed to the employer. Do you see it that way, Tom? And is that true across the board of some of the stuff we're going to be discussing?
I think that, yes, generally the laws that we're talking about are moving in favor of employees and, yeah, protecting employee status, protecting employees from forced arbitration. And then with SB 707, like Scott was just talking about, I think, you know, this is a really interesting bill because, you know, as a management attorney, clients come to me and they want advice. They want to know how to go about setting up arbitration, and they want to enforce arbitration agreements. It's fascinating to think that they would force somebody into a relationship and then game it to avoid the process, you know, running its course. If you choose arbitration or if you enter into an agreement, period, you should expect to live by it. So I see SB 707 as really a kick in the behind to say live by the agreements that you enter into. And that would be advice I'd give my employer clients regardless.
What other new laws are on the books that are going to change the landscape coming into the next year?
One we haven't touched on yet is AB 9, which is essentially an extension of the deadline to file a case for discrimination or harassment or anything that falls under the Fair Employment and Housing Act, or abbreviated as FEHA, which prohibits discrimination, harassment, and retaliation based on protected characteristics in the workplace. So in the past, if an employer came up to an employee and said, I'm firing you because you're a woman, you know, that's straight ahead discrimination based on gender. That employee would have 1 year to go to the Department of Fair Employment and Housing, the DFEH, and you've got to go to the DFEH and exhaust your administrative remedies before you could ever go into court. Well, what was happening, and we saw kind of with the rise of the Me Too movement, is that sometimes it takes employees a little while to kind of understand what they've gone through, number one, or number two, be willing to speak up without the fear of retaliation. Let's say you were sexually harassed. You didn't want to bring it up because of fearing retaliation. And, you know, you finally got a new job, but it turns out you had to file a case within 1 year. And, you know, that's a very short statute of limitations. And basically what this law is designed to do is it takes it from the 1 year that you previously had and makes it 3 years to file with the DFEH. And then once the DFEH gets the case, they can either investigate it or you can get what's called a right to sue letter, which says we're going to kind of close things down at the DFEH, but you can go into court and sue. And you still have 1 year to file your case in court once the DFEH concludes what it's going to do. And Tom, I don't know, I think from an employer perspective, this probably has some significant impact when it comes to document retention and things like that, if we're now extending it to 3 years.
Yeah, we have to remind our clients that, you are subject to potential, you know, risk and exposure for longer. If you engage in some, you know, risky activity. And so, it's important to retain documents, keep good records, and, you know, just be prepared in the event something, some issue arises.
And I think also that this this law brings it in line with a lot of other statutes where there's been a wrong, like personal injury has a 2-year statute of limitation, fraud 3 years, breach of a written contract 4 years. So it brings it in line with that. Also, the 3 years kind of helps both sides of this matter in the sense that they have more time to work out an amicable resolution maybe before something ever needs to get filed. Which you didn't have before. When you're up against this tight timeline, you may have to initiate something just because you've got a deadline ahead of you, and now you can kind of actually have a discussion and negotiation without that intense time pressure.
Let me turn it to Greg in Palo Alto. Greg, we have a very short time left, but I'll give you a couple minutes.
Okay. Hopefully this won't be too far off the subject. If it is, then, you know, I wouldn't expect your guests to go into this. I'm wondering, in terms of labor law, what they might be able to say briefly about any kind of protections that California has for people who are whistleblowers. In particular, I'm thinking about, I was a teacher who ran into a situation where this was I was involved in, and I'm just wondering what the current status is in California whistleblower law.
Yeah, well, I think that there are a number of whistleblower-type laws in California, so I would say that, you know, depending upon what you are blowing the whistle about, that's going to impact which law is going to cover you. For instance, I would consider blowing the whistle if you, let's say you see somebody who is sexually harassed at the workplace and you bring that up to upper management, that could be considered blowing the whistle. And under the FEHA, you have protection from being retaliated against for blowing the whistle on this illegal sexual harassment conduct that you witnessed, meaning if they retaliated against you for reporting this illegal activity, you'd be protected. So likewise, there's also the California Labor Code 1102.5, which allows you to, if you have a reasonable based belief and that you're reporting something to either a government agency or to somebody above you with control at the company about an area where you believe to be to have seen something illegal happen, you know, that's another area where you have whistleblower protection. And I'm speaking now in kind of the non-unionized employee workplace.
Okay, thank you.
Greg, thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights. And as we're just about out of time, I'd like to give each of you, you know, one to two minutes to give us any closing thoughts you have or any summaries you want to give.
Sure, this is Tom. And I think that at the end of every year, it's important for businesses across the state as well as for employees to take a look at what the new laws are. A lot of things that have been in the news percolate through the legislature and to the governor's desk, and they change the chemistry of the workplace. We spend a lot of time in my office trying to get employers up to speed with these laws, make them aware, and encourage them to revise their policies, do required trainings, and to take the steps to be legally compliant, because we believe that by being aware and legally compliant, you can run a better business and be a better participant in the economy and the community.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. And this is Scott now. I would just say that, it's interesting to... This is the first year that Governor Gavin Newsom has been the governor. And I think you're seeing that elections really do matter because take that AB 51, the forced arbitration bill. I mean, that was something that basically versions of that have come up in years past, and Governor Brown always vetoed that bill. And now Governor Newsom signed it. And so, it really does matter who you are electing into these positions. And so taking our right to vote seriously is something that, I would really encourage because it does make a big difference. And I would also add, it is important, I think, for employees in particular to understand that when it comes to these arbitration agreements, you don't have to be signing these clauses anymore, and I think that's important.
And one last thing I've walked away with tonight, listening to the two of you, is this is still an area that's rapidly evolving, and a lot of people could easily see the paradigm changing fairly quickly, and maybe fairly often. So if there was a time that it would make sense to get a consultation, this would probably be a good one if in doubt. Your local lawyer referral service will do so. We'll give you a half-hour consultation for a very nominal fee. They have them in San Francisco, which covers San Francisco and Marin County, Alameda County, San Mateo County, which covers San Mateo and northern Santa Clara County. Again, very nominal fee for a half-hour consultation. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight, the end of the year rapidly approaching, we've been talking about new employment laws for 2020. Joining me, my guests tonight, appear courtesy of the Labor and Employment Law section of the California Lawyers Association. Again, my thanks to the section for all of the good work and the help that they've given us putting shows together throughout the year. And with me tonight, labor and employment attorneys Thomas Lenz from Pasadena, California, a partner in the firm of Atkinson, Endelson, Loya, Rude, and Romo, and from San Francisco, Scott Stillman from the firm of McGinn, Hilsman, and Pileski in San Francisco. Scott, Tom, thank you both for joining me tonight.
Thank you, Jeff.
My pleasure, Jeff. Thank you.
And a big shout out and thank you to all the lawyers participating in Call a Lawyer Night, both tonight and throughout the year. Next week, Your Legal Rights, in what will be our last broadcast of 2019, looks at the changing criminal law paradigm as we move away from mass incarceration towards education and treatment and the specialty courts that guide the implementations of these treatment regimen. My guests will include Emmy Award-nominated legal and political analyst Dean Johnson and Judge Mark Forkum. Again, tonight, you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. For my guests, Thomas Lenz and Scott Stillman, and production assistant Martin McLean, I'm Jeff Hayden. Our thanks to you for listening, and have a good night.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Refer Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. You can always call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.